From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Ruben Navarrete, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's a Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, Donald Trump picks on Latinos. Whether he's bullying an immigrant, beauty queen, or federal judge, Trump can barely hide his contempt for America's largest minority. It can't be good for anyone's self-esteem to be constantly told you're ruining the country. Now comes the hit animated film Coco, which gives Latinos a positive portrayal of a family that resembles their own. Is it enough to counter Trump's anti-Latino offensive? We'll find out. That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist and host of the podcast Navarrete Nation. Imagine being told repeatedly by the President of the United States that you're the problem, that the country would be a much better place if you weren't in it. Imagine hearing that your immigrant grandfather was a criminal, a bad hombre, who preyed upon real Americans and pilfered the nation's resources. And you know not a word of it is true. And if you weren't so busy working, paying your taxes, and raising good kids, hey, you'd stick around and correct the record. But just when your self-esteem could use a boost, Miguel comes along.
This isn't a dream, then. You're all really out there.
You thought we weren't?
Well, I don't know. I thought it might have been one of those made-up things that adults tell kids, like vitamins.
The hit movie Coco is about the Day of the Dead. It tells the story of young Miguel, who wants to be a musician, and he finds his inspiration on the other side when he meets his deceased relatives. Join me now to discuss the film and the mysterious effect it's having on Latinos is Myra Garcia, digital editor at the New York Times Culture Section. Hello, Myra. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So you produced a very interesting article that I'm sure was emotional for you to write. It was emotional for me to read. You listed a series of comments from people, both Latinos and non-Latinos, who had seen Coco. Some of the responses were very emotional. I don't know if you teared up in reading them, but I sure did. And having seen the movie now yourself, were you surprised that the reaction to this film cuts so deep?
You know, I don't think it really was. It was a very emotional experience for myself as well, being Mexican-American and first generation, and also having loved ones, including my mother, passed away, you know, 5 years ago. So for me personally, it was a very moving film. And so when we solicited readers' responses to the film, they were equally, if not more so, emotional in so many cases. And we just received an overwhelming response, and much of it was very positive.
So I'd like to read one of the reader's comments that's in your article. It goes like this, quote, "I took my mom to see it, to go see it with me. And we lit up at the sight of a Mexican family that wasn't negatively stereotypical. I was amazed by the tamales wrapped in corn husks, the abuelita who got upset that Miguel said no to more food. My favorite part in this is a small throwaway moment when someone in the crowd yells out, eso, that's it, when Miguel is playing, because I hear it all the time. Phrases like que padre and que onda made this movie great for me because it felt like I was hearing my family." That's from Adrian Vallejo. Myra, Latino culture looms large in this film. There's no doubt about it. Why do you think the movie has for Latinos turned out to be, well, kind of emotional dynamite?
Well, you know, representation is really just low in general when it comes to media and films and television. So to see a not stereotype version of the Latino community, it was just, you know, it felt like a big breath of fresh air, especially after this past year. So I think, you know, readers were just happy to see someone who looked like them, that those small touches that the film incorporated, like whether it was the tamales or the changla or, you know, one part that really stood out to me was the pink cake on the immigration officer's desk. I was like, oh, yes, that's perfect. Like, I ate that pink cake growing up. Like, I remember seeing it in the panaderia.
That's
like,
right.
Those were all little touches that just meant so much that they really got it right.
No, that's true. I think the panaderia was my happy space growing up. You know, it's a warm and happy place. I got you. I never saw pink cake anywhere else. I was scared. That was the only place.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Joining us now in studio is Daniel Hernandez, the journalist, writer, former Mexico bureau chief for Vice News. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hey.
Hey. ¿Qué onda? As they say in Coco. So I want us to listen to a scene from the movie. It's right after Miguel arrives at the land of the dead, and we see the skeleton arrive at a checkpoint. He gets his face scanned for recognition, but no result comes up.
No photo on an ofrenda, no crossing the bridge.
You know what? I'm just gonna zip right over. You won't even know I'm gone.
Almost.
There. Just a little further.
Oopsie daisy.
Fine, okay. Fine, who cares? Dumb flower bridge.
I don't know what I'd do if no one put up my photo.
Next.
Oh. So we just heard Hector, who's trying to cross the bridge to the land of the living, and he can't do it because no one put his photo on the ofrenda, on the altar. So, Daniel, tell us more about this scene with the bridge and why you wrote that Coco is politically subversive work. Use your words. What do you mean by that?
Well, I thought that scene was pretty analogous to the actual border that exists today, the actual crossing over that people who live in Mexico or were deported, let's say, to Mexico, removed to Mexico in the parlance of today, can relate to in this kind of basic structural way, which is that someone needs to let you go to the other side. And I think that the message was pretty clear. I mean, of course, we're talking about an imaginary scenario, a magical scenario, a scenario aimed at children. But all of the sort of icons of the border checkpoint as we know it today were right there in the film. And it kind of feels unfair for Hector to not be able to cross to the land of the living in this film.
Now, even before the movie came out, you know, in the pre-release publicity, some of the stars brought Donald Trump into the discussion. They said that the film was a kind of antidote to what they saw as President Trump's anti-Latino bigotry, because it does provide such a positive portrayal of Latino culture and arguably just when the community needs it most. Now, do you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, when you think about some of the stuff that children in this country who are brown in some way, who are Mexican in some way, who are Latino in some way, have been feeling over the past couple of years. You know, I was remembering during the campaign just now that in the middle of America, there were people, teams were yelling, build a wall to opposing teams with largely Hispanic high school populations at basketball games and at football games. That's very painful to hear, having been myself someone who grew up, you know, I came of age as a teenager in the 90s. Here in California, we had Pete Wilson, you know, basically comparing us to cockroaches crossing the border. That was very painful and hurtful to me as a 13 and a 14-year-old. Imagine now seeing these kinds of images, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, and then just at this moment, this film comes along where being Mexican is front and centered and is really celebrated and treated in a very nuanced and celebratory way.
You know, Daniel, you mentioned, I'm glad you did this episode that we've seen at various high schools where they talk about building the wall. They use it now as a taunt. If you have a team that's mostly white playing basketball or something against a team that's mostly Latino, right, from the other side of town, they'll say, build the wall. And one of the interesting things is they start chanting USA, USA, which really bothers me and a lot of other U.S.-born Latinos, right?
100%.
Who love this country deeply. And so that's another aspect of the story. Now, I got to say now, in a special treat for me, I'd like to welcome into the conversation an old friend of mine from my native Central California. Martin Matis is a retired teacher and the founder and CEO of the Ivy League Project, which helps get disadvantaged Latino students into elite universities. Hi, Martin. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Ruben.
So you've worked your whole career with young people, okay? A lot of the adolescents that you deal with through the Ivy League Project, most of them Latino, many of them first generation. You know firsthand how important it is for those who come from nothing to have high self-esteem and develop what I've called and you've called a sense of possibility about what they can accomplish. How do you think a positive movie like Coco might help empower Latino youths to live out their dreams?
Well, I think just watching a movie, as I sat there the other day and I watched the audience, I saw older people, young kids, and they were just involved and emotionally involved in the movie and just taking it in. And I asked my kids, and they were real proud of being Mexican American and also seeing themselves in the movie. And we were having a conversation with my son. He's 18 years of age and just graduated out of high school. And we were talking about, you know, the impact of the movie that it had on him, and he would just say, you know, Dad, it was just exciting to see a movie that recognizes our culture, validates our cultural awareness, or of his grandparents and his parents and so on. It was a moving experience. I think that this movie will serve to really help students understand who they are and validate themselves, that it's okay to be Mexican-American, you know. With all of these negative comments coming up from the president about these rapists and murderers and so on, you know, I could tell the students, I said, do you need to make sure that you don't listen to people that are negative in your life and make sure that you listen to people that are positive, they're going to affirm you and validate you. So I think that movie is really... It's exciting. Really exciting to see, you know, Pixar take our culture and validate it in this new scene.
Now, Martin, I understand you saw the movie two times, both in English and Spanish.
Yeah, I know.
All right? Just quickly tell me, I want to move back to our other guests as well, but quickly tell me, what was the difference for you in terms of receiving the movie in English and in Spanish?
Oh, God, what a big difference. I heard... you know, watching the movie on Saturday, the other day, watching in English, I saw people tearing up left and right. I mean, I even had a tear and so on. And then I went to see it in Spanish, and I was like, oh, my God, I was able to understand it a lot more clear. I was able to hear their voice and their passion for who they are and their feelings. I was able to really... just really feel the movie, and really, it was really emotional for me because I heard it in my native tongue.
Now, Myra, I want to go back to you. You got hundreds of responses from people who'd seen the movie. What about the responses from non-Latino viewers? What did you hear from them?
You know, I think those were some of the most interesting. It was an eye-opening experience for many people, and just I think a respectful way for them to see. What this culture is about and being able to discuss it openly with their children, too. It just gave audiences a different perspective, I think, and it really opened their eyes to the fact that there's a lot of layers to our culture, like there is with any culture, really.
Now, Daniel, you had an interesting experience as well because you watched the film not only in Spanish, but in Mexico. You
right.
watched it first in Mexico. I'm dying to know, how did that go? Tell us about that experience.
Well, yeah, I was in Mexico just before Thanksgiving, and I was like, I'm going to take advantage of this, and I'm going to see it before all my American friends get to see it. I went at a Cineplex right in the middle of Mexico City, and it was a pretty amazing experience. Our Uber driver had seen it 5 times already, and, you know, urban people don't have the same kind of cultural connections to the traditions of the Día de Muertos, but they still kind of were really loving it. I really got to hand it, and hats off to the cultural consultants and all the people that Pixar employed, both Mexican and Mexican-American,
right.
who really were, I think, instrumental in making sure that none of this read as exploitative, as misrepresentative, that it was really right there. And that kind of care, I think, could only happen in the kind of cultural climate that we are in today. You know, I was thinking about like Moana and Aladdin.
Sure.
And the kinds of things that would go over regarding other cultures, but to hear have Pixar do something about Mexican culture in this charged moment, I would have to say that they were pretty successful.
You had this very interesting line in your piece where you said, I knew this was going to be a big phenomenon when the Uber driver
right.
in Mexico says, oh, yeah, I love that movie. I've seen it 5 times already.
Yeah, but I mean, Mexico is a place saturated with so much content like here and actually so much pirated
sure.
content that it was already being sold on the sidewalk.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get to Myra again, to the response. I know we've talked about the politics of it, and we've talked about sort of how people might make a connection, as Daniel did, between the Day of the Dead, the walk across bridge, and the border. Did you get any of that at all from some of your responses and some of your the people who called in to talk about the film?
Yeah. You know, I had a commenter named Adriana who described her experience being a dreamer here in the United States and not having been able to see her family for 17 years as a result of that. And, you know, having missed family members' funerals and missing her family, and how Dia de los Muertos provided a connection in a sense, because even though she couldn't be there, she could still honor and celebrate their memory. And in some ways, this film was able to capture that emotion.
I had a question for Martin as well. Martin, it's sort of interesting. You've got these kids that you work with who are very hard-charging, 4.0 valedictorian types who are going off to these elite universities with your help. But they also come from first-generation families. Their parents speak only Spanish. Some of their parents may be undocumented. And certainly they're the first to go to this level of college. So there's a bit of a paradox there. People look at this and they say, well, those people must be almost bulletproof to this. These young people might be bulletproof because, well, look, America's embraced them. They've got all these opportunities. That's not always the case, is it?
No way. You know, these are students that they have the grit. They have the ganas. These are students that, in spite of what the world throws at them, they're tenacious and they're academics. And it's imperative that they have mentors, people like myself or their parents, that to tell them that they have to, you know, be focused, that they have to do better than what themselves. You know, I remember my father. I said, my father used to tell me, "Mijo, no seas burro como yo. Tienes que ir al colegio. You can't be a donkey, son. You need to go to college." But you know, it's just imperative. These students are high achieving. They're tenacious in their academic studies.
Stop you there, Martin. We're going to come back to this conversation after the break. We're going to have to leave it there for just a minute. If you want to share your perspective with us, go to our webpage, kcrw.org/1year later. We're going to take a quick break. We'll return to our discussion of Coco and whether it's building Latino self-esteem when we come back. This is 1 year later from KCRW. Welcome back. I'm Ruben Navarrete, and this is 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I want to remind you that you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm joined by Daniel Hernandez, journalist, writer, and former Mexico City bureau chief for Vice News, Myra Garcia, who's digital editor at the New York Times culture section, and Martin Matas, a retired teacher and the founder of the Ivy League Project. Welcome back to everyone.
Hey, Ruben.
So, Daniel, I just want to ask you, you know, I've heard from a number of people that when they go to this movie, they cry. We talked about it. And I get a sense that there's a number of reasons people are crying and responding to this movie so emotionally, Latinos in particular. But I hear two things over and over again. One is that they're remembering, obviously, their own relatives. It's just impossible to go to a movie about death in the Latino community and not flash back to your own abuelita or someone else that you've lost, your own grandmother. But also there's a sense of pride. I've heard from a lot of older people in particular who are 50, 60, 70 years old, who say, "I've been waiting my whole life for a movie like this." And they have, they'd almost given up hope they were ever going to see that. Which of those two things are you hearing the most of, and did you personally feel?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a very emotionally charged film in a way that, you know, many of these mainstream mass audience films don't get to be. I was really trying hard to kind of keep the images of my own grandmothers out of my head because I didn't want to completely lose it.
I hear you.
In the theater. But it was really reaching across all of these lines. I think it was a tweet by Anna Paquin who was saying something like, "I had to leave the theater with sunglasses on because I was bawling so much.
True.
I think it really is a kind of a universal emotion that the film is touching. However, there is this other layer for us, those of us who are brown, who are Latino, who are Mexican-American, where we've seen something again, like that audience member said, that they hadn't seen before, that maybe we haven't seen since perhaps La Bamba or Selena from decades past.
Right.
That is a film that is reaching mainstream audiences, but really reflects who we are and all those complexities and nuances.
Quick story. You mentioned about keeping the image of your grandmother deliberately out of your mind, because if not, you're just going to lose it right there in the theater, right, and start bawling. I was writing a column. I wrote a syndicated column about Coco and also a piece for the Daily Beast about it. So I'm at a coffee shop, and I can't get my grandmothers, both of them, out of my mind. Mm-hmm. So I'm crying in the coffee shop as I'm typing on my keyboard, and people think I'm crazy. And I was teased about that on Facebook. I said, "Sabes que, if you're Latino and you don't cry when you think of your dead grandmother, turn in your card."
Yeah.
Okay?
There you go.
You're out of the club. Myra, Why did they go to the trouble, the producers in this film, who, as Daniel pointed out, were often Latinos, they had Latino consultants on the film, it made a big difference. Why did they decide to screen this film in Mexico first?
Well, you know, obviously they wanted to get the story right. And, you know, they actually did screenings even before the film was released at all. And there were a few things that they changed as a result of feedback from the Latino community, including the point about the grandmother, the abuelita. And I think originally in the film, they had this scene where she was wielding a spoon and, you know, would hit people with that. But they're like, no, no, that's not what abuelita Litas do. Like they use the chanclas, so you know,
the
even that
a shoe,
subtle,
shoe or a slipper, or, sandal,
and a sandal flip flop, and you know, that little like detail, yes, like that the chancla I think is ubiquitous in the Mexican American and even larger Latino experience. So you know, and they also obviously wanted to avoid any sort of negative publicity. They did encounter at one point, they had tried to trademark the Day of the Dead, and that didn't go over well, obviously.
Right.
And they withdrew their application for that. But, you know, it was part of the lesson of, like, if you're going to do it right. And if you're not, then people are going to call you out on it. And I think they realize that, and so they really put a heavy emphasis on spending time in Mexico and
right.
bringing in those consultants.
Myra, it's amazing the kind of response I've been hearing from people. Coco worldwide has generated over $400 million in box office success, but there's got to be some negative reaction as well. What have you been hearing in terms of any negative response to the film from either the right or the left or somewhere in between?
So, I mean, any negative response, it was really small, but there are, like, I've seen a blog post reflecting on how it doesn't accurately portray the Latino experience because they felt like it didn't include as much sort of indigenous perspective or, you know, sort of like the LGBTQ question, too. And I understand that, like, those are, you know, points of views that are welcome at the table, and I mean, overall, like, it's really been positive.
Yeah, good. Well, Martin, I have a question for you as well about those, that positive reaction, and sort of the backdrop to give people some background about your program and about the students you work with. How have you dealt with in the past? This is not just Donald Trump wasn't the first politician to ever come forward and try to make a negative of Latino culture for the sake of politics. How have you, throughout your career in dealing with young people, tried to help them withstand all of that and just stay focused on accomplishing their dreams and really put aside what others are saying about them?
You know, Ruben, through the project, we've been able to focus on by bringing in professional speakers to come in and talk to our students, whether it be the McFarland USA, Diaz Brothers, to talk to them about perseverance, about having a winning attitude, to bringing in Latino attorneys or students that have graduated from Ivy League universities, from MIT or Brown or Princeton, and for them to give their experience, to talk to them about, you know, it's going to be tough, you know, it is going to be tough, but you have to persevere, and this is what it's all about. It's about having the ganas and the grit to make things happen and accomplish your goals and bring somebody along, you know.
So let me ask you, as an educator, we've been talking about the benefits of the film, but specifically to children and to students, I wonder how much of this translates. After all, you know, I take my kids to this movie. They're at 8, 10, 12 years old. You're dealing with teenagers in many cases. Do you get a sense that it still sort of resonates with them and they take something from it?
Oh, definitely. You know, as I sat there, I saw a number of teenagers in the movie house bawling, as well as Dad here, and just watching them, I was just amazed at the movie, and it was an incredible experience. I'd never seen a movie such as that resonates so well with our Latino community.
Now, Daniel, we spoke before about the criticism and Martin just responded to this question of how teenagers responded to the movie and how it impacted them. But in terms of some of the criticism for folks who aren't getting that full impact, have you heard anybody say that we're making too much out of this from a cultural point of view, that folks on the right who say, you know, why does it have to be a Latino movie or not a Latino movie? Why can't there just be movies? Why does everything have to be political? You know, Donald Trump got dragged into the discussion for this. I've heard only a bit of that in response to some of the things I've written. What have you heard?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the main argument that has been from people, I would say, who sort of take a very hard intellectual eye at this, that this film is, you know, an evidence of cultural appropriation. You know, these are the kinds of accusations that have been made at Disney films over the years at different levels. I think this year in particular, it's a very sensitive time for this notion of cultural appropriation. At the end of the day, Disney and Pixar are massive global corporations and they're profiting enormously, obviously, from this film. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is entertainment. It's entertainment geared at children, geared at families. You know, there was also debate and criticism about the latching on of this Frozen short feature at the beginning of the film.
Oh, yeah, boy.
You know, and I heard from people who were also kind of like, well, I have kids, so I need them to be sitting as long as possible. And even if it's, you know, some snowy sort of setting before this very brown sort of lush Mexican setting, we can live with it as long as we get to the good stuff, I guess. So at the end of the day, I think these criticisms will sort of shed off because, you know, again, it's a Disney film and we should treat it as such.
I want to ask you about a phrase you use, and I have not heard it used in this discussion in the weeks since the film came out, cultural appropriation. And the funny thing is, if Disney had done this, Pixar, with a tinier, as Hollywood has typically approached many Latino movies, with no Latino consultants, they get it wrong. They option like Isabel Allende's book, House of Spirits, and they cast Jeremy Irons and Winona Ryder, non-Latinos in the movie, right? All blows up. Well, if they had done that with Coco, then there would have been a complaint about cultural appropriation. But in this case, it almost seems like Latinos don't mind it.
Yeah.
They don't mind that their culture was used this way because it was such a beautiful product and it did have a lot of Latino consultants, producers, actors driving the project.
Absolutely. And I think it's a very sort of simple, it's just a very simple truth. We see photos, we see films out of India and that we know and love universally and globally. We see films that relate to East Asian characters that we see and love globally. I think Mexico as a culture, as a country, as a place that has been around for thousands and thousands of years, is every bit as valid a kind of a place to draw from narratively for film and for books and for television. And I do hope that this would encourage all the big studios and all the major studios to explore more films that take place or refer to the Mexican experience or the Mexican-American experience.
I want to get back to Myra and Martin, but Daniel, before I leave you, I want to talk a little bit more about sort of the name and the concept of our show, for instance, is 1 year later because we check in with issues and on issues 1 year into the Trump era and presidency. On one side, you have this Trump rhetoric against Latinos who, you know, I could cite 20 instances. You could, too, just since he arrived on the public stage. On the other, you've got Coco. On the other side of the seesaw, you have Coco and perhaps other projects and other representations, positive representations that could be coming out of Hollywood in the years to come. Where are we overall when it comes to Latino self-esteem? How do you see all that balancing out?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that we even have to kind of have this scenario, that we have to answer these kinds of statements from the president who should be the president for the whole country. Having said that, it is very important for artists and for writers and for journalists and for all of us to really speak up and counter. And I think this film happily arrives a year after this individual took office as president of the country. And it is a very healthy and very welcome counterpoint. And if this film would have come out maybe a couple years ago, it wouldn't have that same level of urgency. But I think for Latino self-esteem, I guess, if you will, it's serving its purpose.
Myra, I want to go to you about the trend now in Hollywood. Now, you keep an eye on Hollywood, and do you think this is part, is this a one-off, a one-time thing that's going to happen, or is there a lesson here? Because the number's so huge, the response is so big, the box office is so big. Is this part of a bigger trend about who's going to be telling stories of various groups going forward?
I mean, I certainly hope so. You know, like I said earlier, studies have shown that representation is very low, and there are audiences out there that really care about these films. And if anything, money talks, and, you know, making $400 million on a film like this that was centered completely on a Latino culture and community, maybe it will turn some eyes and, you know, get producers and executives at these studios to realize that there is a market for this. And when you do it right, it'll only, you know, produce positive dividends for you, and whether that's monetarily or otherwise.
Myra, I want to ask you and Daniel as well. We heard from Martin that he watched both versions, English and Spanish. I understand that both of you watched both versions as well. The more I think about it, there's a lot to be said about this in terms of how we receive our information as Latinos. I heard somebody say that the English version very much spoke to their head and they loved it, but the Spanish version spoke to their heart and they felt it, you know? So I want to get a sense from each of you. Myra, you first. What did you like better? Which one did you like better, the English or the Spanish, and why?
You know, for the Spanish version, for me, the music was just, I don't know, it just had so much more emotion. And then you have someone like Marco Antonio Solís, who, you know, is a big star in Mexico and has been for decades. And he sung the Ernesto de la Cruz songs and voiced the character. It was beautiful. And hearing that, like, you know, took me back to, like, Saturday mornings when my mom would blast Marco Antonio Solís to wake me up. And so it felt very personal in that way and lovely.
Daniel, I want to hear from you as well.
Yeah.
On the Spanish and English versions, which one did you like better and why?
Completely agree with what Myra said. I mean, the music was really clutch there. The transition between the dialogue to the music was really seamless in Spanish. And I was listening to some of these songs, which happened to be original. And I was even asking myself, oh, are these old, you know, rancheras that I should know? But in English, it was also very effective. The small sprinkling of Spanglish, I think, was really well done. And I'm thinking, you know, for example, the success of the series Narcos on Netflix, which is almost entirely in Spanish. American audiences are capable of absorbing a good story, even if it's in a foreign language, and especially, I would say, now in Spanish.
Well, Daniel, I've got to have a disclosure here. I'm going to see the film only in English because I'm not going to be able to make my way through the Spanish. An entire film in Spanish. My Spanish, not so good. You know, next time you hear Latinos aren't assimilating, that's a lie.
Yeah,
okay?
Totally.
Many of us assimilate to the point where we lose the Spanish, unfortunately. We're going to have to leave that conversation now. It's been a great conversation. We'll leave it here. Thanks to all my guests, Daniel Hernandez, journalist, writer, and former Mexico City bureau chief for Vice News, Myra Garcia, who's digital editor at the New York Times culture section, and Martin Matis, a retired teacher and founder of the Ivy League Project. After a break, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with 1 year later from KCRW. Hi, I'm Ruben Navarrete, back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out. We talk through different big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the center, we're bringing in Bill Scherer, who's contributing editor at Politico, as our voice from the left. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. So we're talking a little bit, the first topic I want to discuss with you, we're talking about judicial nominees. At a hearing today, a Trump judicial nominee, actually, I'm sorry, it was a hearing earlier in the week, a Trump judicial nominee failed a legal quiz when he struggled to answer basic questions put to him by Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana about his lack of experience on trial work, about the amount of depositions he's worked on, and more. Matthew Spencer Peterson, who's up for a seat on the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, which is a prestigious seat, couldn't answer, and it didn't sound good.
Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Criminal?
No.
Bench? State or federal court?
I have not.
Okay. Have you ever taken a deposition?
I was involved in taking depositions when I was associate at Wiley Ryan when I first came out of law school. But that was...
Have you ever... How many depositions?
I would... I'd be struggling to remember.
Less than 10?
Yes.
Less than 5?
Probably somewhere in that range.
This is Senator Kennedy going hard on a Trump nominee. Bill, you know, when it comes to Trump's personnel decisions, I get really confused. It's such a mixed bag for somebody who built a whole TV career based on this idea that he's supposedly a great judge of talent. You've got the solid picks like H.R. McMaster, John Kelly, Nikki Haley, James Mattis. But you also have people like this guy, Peterson, who seems like he missed a lot of days in law school. Yeah, how do you make sense of all that?
Well, you know, the Democrats at the tail end of Obama's tenure changed the rules so you could not filibuster judicial nominees anymore. And when Republicans took full control of Washington, they guffawed, ha ha, you silly Democrats, now we can put whoever we want on the bench and you can't stop us. That has taken away a degree of restraint, which perhaps you might want to have if you think you can just pluck any right-wing hack and plop them on the court, someone's going to raise their hand and say, wait a second, maybe that's not such a good idea. And John Kennedy, who was a very conservative senator from Louisiana, however, he was a Democrat until 2007. In fact, he endorsed John Kerry for president in 2004. And the governor of Louisiana is a Democrat who has a 53% approval rating. So Louisiana is a more complicated state than you might assume. And with the margin in the Senate so narrow, it's 52-48 now, it's soon going to be 51-49. You lose a couple senators and boom, you don't get your judge anymore. And a senator is going to say, if my vote is going to be associated with a total embarrassment for a lifetime appointment, that's going to hang over my head for a very long time, and I don't want to be a part of it. So Kennedy's waving a big red flag to Trump. You better do some serious vetting if you want to get the judges you want on the court.
Yeah, you know, Kennedy himself is a lawyer. He just seemed appalled. I mean, he was polite enough. You know, he didn't want to make it seem like a gotcha session, but you could tell he was really disappointed in the lack of responses he was getting from Mr. Peterson. Now, Trump has had a pretty good track record of getting his federal judicial nominees, 12 appellate court judges, 5 district court judges on the appellate level, getting them through. In fact, I understand he's broken the record for a president in his first year in office. This is all because of a Senate rule change. Do I have that right?
Well, that's right. It's kind of an apples to oranges comparison. Because you don't have that 60 vote threshold anymore, it is easier to get your picks on. Obama did a lot of vetting for his judges. He wanted no mistakes. He didn't want to get tagged by Republicans for doing anything overtly political. So they took their time for a while. And of course, there was lots of obstruction on the Republican side for a lot of their judges. So it wasn't until that rule change happened, when Democrats had a burst of judicial confirmations in a second term, which then slowed down towards the end once they got into this whole blue slip issue, which I don't know if your listeners want to get into the deep weeds of judicial politics. But it's a way for home state senators to block picks. And some home state senators are Republican. So Obama had some difficulty with that in the last couple of years.
You know, Bill, I'd love to get into the deep weeds of Alabama politics, in fact. Now to talk about the Alabama Senate race and Senator-elect Doug Jones. You know, the political world is still adjusting to his upset victory in that race, where he defeated the embattled Republican opponent, Roy Moore. A lot of conversation in the last 48 hours has been about whether Jones can be the model of a kind of new Southern Democrat, smart, progressive. He's able to bring together people from across the spectrum. If Jones pulls that off and becomes a symbol of the new South, what would that mean for our political system? It would be huge, no?
Oh, it could totally reshuffle the map. And it's a massive opportunity and a massive risk for Doug Jones. He has to run again in 2020. So he's finishing out Jeff Sessions' term. He doesn't get that luxurious 6-year window to kind of get his sea legs, keep his head down, get the votes get more acclimated to him. He's on the hot seat right away. Every vote's going to be scrutinized. And if he's like Scott Brown, you know, Scott Brown, Massachusetts, won very similarly. 1 year after Obama was elected, deep blue state of Massachusetts, Scott Brown comes out of nowhere, upends the Obama agenda, presaged the Republican wave in 2010. But he only lasted for 2 years in the Senate because he voted like a Republican most of the time. And Elizabeth Warren came around and booted him out of office. So if Jones just votes like a Democrat and does nothing else of import, he would suffer the same fate. But he now has an enormous platform. I mean, every reporter, every TV show is going to ask him to come on. Give me what's the Democratic Southern voice have to say about this or that?
Right.
It's an opportunity to redefine what the Democratic Party means in the South. They've been so caricatured for so long. Here's a guy who seems like a nice guy, a pleasant guy. Moore tried to call him a baby killer. It didn't stick. John Bel Edwards, who is that Democrat governor of Louisiana, said if you can get past that abortion and gun stuff, the Democratic message can resonate in the South. Jones has a chance to prove that if he can translate National Party, Democratic Party vernacular to Southern vernacular.
You know, Bill, I could see Doug Jones being treated like a rock star for sure when he gets to Washington. I could also see him be treated sort of as an enigma because, as you point out, he's got to run for reelection in a conservative state. Don't be surprised if he doesn't run up and give Chuck Schumer a big warm embrace right at the beginning. It may be that he takes a more conservative route, at least at the start. So we'll have to watch him very carefully, won't we?
Yeah. He promised in the race, I will work across party lines. I will get things done. He can't be a reflexive Democratic vote if he's to survive. But he also can't just be a Trump lackey and get that Democratic base to show up in the same numbers in 2020. So he has a very fine line to walk.
Now, if he's able to build out of this, if Democrats are able to build on this Jones victory, and not only for Jones's national reputation, but also in terms of winning again seats in 2018, they have hopes of recapturing the House of Representatives. If Doug Jones were going to give Democrats just one piece of advice in Congress about how to replicate his victory, what do you think he'd tell them?
I mean, Doug Jones ran with a tone of civility, bipartisanship, decency, getting things done. It wasn't a hard economic populist message. It wasn't, you know, he didn't go single payer the way some Bernie-crats want Democrats to do. He didn't go hard at Trump either. He went hard on Moore, but he really left Trump alone. And that was very specific to being in a very Trump-friendly area. Now, not every House district's going to be like that. You know, a lot of the Republican right. House districts are in upscale, diverse, high college education areas. You would run a different kind of campaign there than you would in a more rockward Republican area. So Democrats can't just do one thing to build that wave. They probably have to do two things at least and tailor that message for those different states. But the Jones model does suggest that that just going hard left on everything is not the secret to winning in those deep red areas.
You know, Bill, one word that popped in my head as you were talking was restraint, not just political restraint, but personal restraint. Imagine running against Roy Moore. If you wanted to get into the mud, you could get into the mud. He gave you so much material to work with. But every single time I saw Doug Jones, he just had his head up high. He stuck to the issues. He was talking about reaching out to people. And I thought that was really impressive. And it worked, seemed to work for him. So maybe that would be a really good lesson, I think, maybe you could take to Washington.
Well, he stayed above the fray. There were other ads.
Right. He stayed above the fray.
that were a little tougher on Moore. But he was very careful to be very, there were a couple of glancing blows at Moore, but he definitely tried to stay clean in this whole process.
Absolutely. Not easy to do in that Alabama Senate race. One quick question as we end this, and that's a conversation about Roy Moore. Do I have this right that Roy Moore has still not conceded, even now days after the election? What kind of timeline are we looking at for Jones to take his seat? And why do you think Roy Moore hasn't conceded?
Well, I mean, the concession is formality. It does not pertain to when Jones gets seated. Moore doesn't have to concede. Mm-hmm. I think Moore is simply feeding his own base of support as someone who sticks his thumb in the eye of the elites in the establishment and doesn't kowtow to what the elites want him to do. Jones's race has to be formally certified by the state. It has not been certified yet. I believe it happens after Christmas. And if Congress wraps up its business before Christmas, which they're trying to do, you wouldn't have the new session until January, and you would get seated then.
Okay, so it's a very important point. Whether or not Roy Moore actually concedes or not, and the reason he's not doing it, it's not really relevant in that regard politically, because Jones will take a seat anyway.
Correct.
Yeah, I'm just curious about what it is that he's, one, waiting for, and two, whether this guy had more of a problem in terms of his own ego than we realized if he won't concede the obvious at this point.
Well, this is a guy that thumbed his nose at the U.S. Supreme Court a couple times,
right,
and got booed out of being the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court and used that as material for future races. This is not a guy who wants to do the polite, chivalrous thing.
Right. Listen, I'm afraid that's all we have time for at the moment here now. I've been joined by Bill Scheer, contributing editor at Politico. Thanks again, Bill.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it for today on One Year Later. Meet us back here on Monday for our show on the continuing crisis and recovery in Puerto Rico. One Year Later was produced this week by Yael Evanor, Sasha Woodruff, and Sarah Fay. The technical director is Mike Uniport. The managing producer is Katie Cooper, and Gwyn O'Toole. Gwyn O'Toole is our executive producer. Today's last note, the song Remember Me from the movie Coco. One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW Los Angeles and Public Radio International. Que yo contigo siempre voy. Recuérdame. If you close your eyes and let the music play, keep our love alive, I'll never fade away. If you close your eyes and let the music play, keep our love alive, I'll never fade away. If you close your eyes and let the music play, keep our love alive, I'll never fade away.
will soon be gone. Remember me and let the love we have.